from LPM.
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
This is Robert Siegel, former host of NPR's All Things Considered. Great Podversations features nationally recognized writers and journalists in candid conversation about books and ideas. Great Podversations is produced by the University of Louisville, Kentucky Author Forum, and it's an honor for me to continue my long relationship with this series, which televises its forums on PBS affiliates as Great Conversations. But today, best-selling author Kurt Anderson discusses his latest book, Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America, A Recent History, with professor and author Darren Acemoglu. Kurt Anderson is the best-selling author of the novels Heyday, Turn of the Century, and True Believers. He's also a contributor to Vanity Fair and the New York Times, and was the host and co-creator of Studio 360, the Peabody Award-winning public radio show and podcast. Anderson writes for television, film, and the stage. He regularly appears as a commentator on MSNBC. Anderson co-founded Spy Magazine, served as editor-in-chief of New York Magazine, and was a cultural columnist and critic for Time Magazine and The New Yorker. Darren Acemoglu is an institute professor at MIT and an elected fellow of the National Academy of Sciences, American Philosophical Society, the British Academy of Sciences, the Turkish Academy of Sciences, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the Econometric Society, the European Economic Association, and the Society of Labor Economists. Acemoglu is the author of 5 books. His academic work covers a wide range of areas, including political economy, economic development, economic growth, technological change, inequality, labor economics, and economics of networks. Darren Acemoglu has received numerous awards, including the inaugural T.W. Schultz Prize from the University of Chicago, the Carnegie Fellowship in 2017, the Global Economy Prize in 2019, and the CME Mathematical and Statistical Research Institute Prize in 2021. We hope that you'll enjoy this great podversation with Kurt Anderson and Darren Acemoglu.
Well, it's my pleasure to be talking to you, Kurt. I've followed your writings over the years, but I really enjoyed Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America. It's a timely, very timely book, given the issues we are facing. And it's also, I think, very timely because this is, I think, the right step for us to first reckon with what has happened over the last 4 decades. So it is an ambitious project, but a very necessary one. So let me start by pointing out one thing that I really like, and then we can go through other things that I also like but have more questions about.
Okay.
You know, you draw this distinction between economics and political economy, and I think it is so critical and so important for understanding a lot of what has happened, the role of public intellectuals in what has happened, the role of perhaps my discipline, economics, in what has happened. It sort of resonates, a quote from the great economist Abba Lerner, who said, economics has become the queen of social sciences by focusing on the politically solved problems. Mm-hmm. And I think Abba Lerner was right, but I think there is a corollary to that, which perhaps is what you have in mind, and I would give you the mic to expand on it. Perhaps economics has also done some damage by pretending that politically unsolved problems are actually solved and ignoring those political dimensions to it. And I think that's the essence of your distinction between economics and political economy.
That's exactly right. And the degree to which it is, and in a way that it wasn't, I guess, you know, certainly before you and I were born, regarded as a science in this scientistic way, that politics isn't even part of it, really. And no, as you've put it, it's exactly correct. And certainly as the public generally understands economics, there's almost no politics to it. And the sort of fundamental political choices about, for instance, you know, do we, well, look at the Federal Reserve's mandate. Is it, as it was until 5 minutes ago, simply to keep inflation low, or is it also to create full employment? Or is it, in addition to all of those things, to combat global warming? So, you know, this idea that, no, it's just about It's just math, and it's just figuring out inputs and outputs, and that's all it is. It does a real disservice, I think, to the political discourse, to just of ordinary citizens' engagement, because they don't think that there is actually disagreement beyond, oh, should the debt be this or that? You know, I mean, and obviously, as you know well, the choices are choices throughout about how, what should be the macro goal of fiscal policy, macroeconomic policy, and everything else. It's not just some kind of applied math pursuit.
Completely agreed. But then let me push that a little further. And this is sort of related to a lot of research I'm doing and a book I'm working on myself. But the same should apply not just to economics, but to lots of other things like technology.
For sure.
I think if there is one area where what you call scientism or, you know, abstraction from all the social and political reality is most intense, is technology. We somehow have come to accept that technology has its own path that we don't decide, and it has a neutral effect, and it doesn't necessarily create winners and losers, and it's not necessarily those who are in control of technology that decide who's a winner, who's a loser. But in some sense, a lot of your story is actually interwoven with how we have used technology and how we have delegated technology to a bunch of not representative, heuristic people.
Yes, couldn't agree more. In fact, another project I just finished, a podcast series about technology in the future called The World as You'll Know It. And I talked to various people, including, just to your very point, this guy Stuart Russell, who's a great scholar of artificial intelligence, wrote one of the textbooks about artificial intelligence. He teaches at UC Berkeley. And really, I spoke to him for a couple of hours. And of course, we know that choices are made, political choices, of all kinds of choices are made about how technology shall be applied. It's not simply, it doesn't just happen, right? I mean, and sometimes those choices are arbitrary and sometimes they're not. But he has this fairly desire to radically remake the premises of artificial intelligence before it's too late, right? Before what he thinks is this big mistake, a kind of the Mickey Mouse and Fantasia Sorcerer's Apprentice version of AI, which says, go do this, AI, and assumes that we, its programmers, know exactly what we want and simply pursues that objective in this fixed way rather than the fundamentally uncertain way in which humans actually behave and don't know what they want from moment to moment and perhaps haven't coded to this AI they've created exactly what they, you know, we want to reduce carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Well, does that mean killing off millions of people to do so? Does that mean, you know, turning the oceans into sulfuric acidic cesspools and so forth? That he really thinks that in that really profound and root way, his whole AI, which he spent his whole career doing, is deeply misguided.
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought that up. It's a bit of a tangent, but let me take that tangent and we'll come back to our main topic. I know Stuart Russell's work. I think he's a great person. I haven't had an opportunity to meet, but I think he is emblematic of a group of AI scientists who are concerned, but I think they are concerned on the wrong thing. They're all concerned on the alignment problem.
Right.
Which is that somehow the big danger is that we're going to create an AI whose goals are not aligned with those of humanity. And that's just that's just because we can't control AI. I tend to think the bigger problem is that some people are controlling AI.
Right.
And they are creating AI aligned with their own vision and their own interests. And that's the one that's really damaging. I don't think there's any chance in our lifetimes or in my children's lifetimes that we're going to have truly super intelligent or even anything close to that. And I don't think the alignment problem is as big of a deal. But I do think that the issue of who controls AI is a big deal and what we want from AI is a big deal. Who controls all that data? Who controls what we do and for whose interests we sort of harvest that data? I think those are, I think, much more important issues. And I worry that this sort of semi-obsession in Silicon Valley and circles around it about with the alignment problem and superintelligence, I see, is making us take our eyes off the real problem.
And I actually agree with that. And the other part of this podcast that I did, I became a kind of one-note person and kept saying to everybody, But don't you, isn't this business model that was chosen by Google and Facebook and thus all of social media to be an ad supported business model 20 years ago, isn't that the root of whatever evil we're seeing, which is to say, maximize user engagement by any means necessary, because that's how you sell, maximize your ad revenue. That seems to me the source of all of our problems, which is exactly as you're saying, which is a choice by, dare I say it, the evil geniuses in charge of Google and Facebook.
Well, actually, okay, this is a great segue, because for my next sort of thing, the book is called Evil Geniuses. And you say early on that you don't believe in conspiracy theories, and this is not a conspiracy theory, and I take that. But it is still a very directed set of disasters. And I guess, to me, it's an interesting thesis, but the alternative, which let me call death by a thousand stupid cuts, is still alive. You know, to put it simply, I think there are two aspects of the evil geniuses thesis that I'm having a hard time swallowing completely. One is that there are many of these evil guys who I would definitely not call a genius, Newt Gingrich, Rudy Giuliani, Trump, you know. So leaving that aside, that's a cheap shot.
And none of those people are in my book, virtually.
Right. But, you know, Newt Gingrich, I mean, I think if you're going to tell a story of evil geniuses in terms of having had a huge effect, Newt Gingrich has to be there. For the other two, okay, I can imagine being left. But Newt Gingrich has to be there. I think he's had as much effect as Lewis Powell on U.S. politics.
I agree. And he is mentioned. But no, absolutely. And by the way, I mean, evil geniuses, of course, is a idiomatic term. And I don't necessarily mean that they're all evil or all geniuses, but that they are malign in their effect, if not their intent. And all I'm saying really is that they have kept their eye on the ball for a long, long time in pursuit of maximum wealth and power for the wealthy and powerful.
So, but let me push that a little bit more.
Sure.
And let me give you my interpretation of, not interpretation, more like a short narrative that is, to me, very challenging and also interesting. And I think it also applies to my discipline that, you know, I think the economist's contribution has been much more by a thousand mistaken cuts rather than, but let me pick from the area of tech again. Mm-hmm. You know, as you rightly recognize and emphasize, you know, tech, business models of tech, the way computers, data, all of these are interwoven with our current predicament, I think those are central. But here is the sort of dilemma here. Like, if you look at the early computer pioneers, the people, you know, at MIT, the hackers, the people in California around Stanford who were trying to sort of integrate software and hardware, including, you know, people like Wozniak, you know, in some sense, they are the farthest away from where we ended up with. They were anti-authoritarian. They hated big firms. In their minds, they thought that they were creating software or hardware that was going to be liberating. And if this actually even applies to, you know, Sergey Brin and Larry Page, their thesis advisor was very much a believer in all of these things. And the way that they originally started approaching things is like very much in the mold of integrating human intelligence and machines. In fact, after all, Google's algorithm is so successful because it leverages enormous amount of knowledge embedded in people's decisions. Doesn't look at what is mentioned on websites, but looks at what choices other people have made in the past, which has a lot of knowledge in it. But then originally they make that open to everybody. They publish their code, etc. But then they get onto this bandwagon of venture capital, ads, and okay, we're going to create a big company. So it's like, rather than a planned type of thing, it's people are being driven by an ideology that they haven't chosen, and they stumble and greatly contribute to this path that has shaped where we are. That's what I mean by the death by a thousand stupid cuts.
I think that's correct. And of course, and one looks at this extraordinary paper that I encourage people to look at if they haven't read it, that Page and Brin wrote in 1998, just as they were starting Google, talking about, well, if search is ever based on advertising, it will destroy it and it will be no good as a result. And it would be terrible. And of course, a moment later, because of, you know, Silicon Valley and venture capital. That's, of course, the path they choose. So, yeah, stumbled into it. But I think, to me, the context, and of course, the story I tell on Evil Geniuses, is that that was happening at this 20 years in, 20 or 30 years into this transformation, this paradigmatic transformation that had taken place in how we think about our political economy and our economic system, at which point there was no real doubt about that stumble. So was it a stumble, or did once the commercial trillions available to them and other people who were starting whatever that Facebook or anything else they were starting, and at that point when the whole idea of government intervention in markets and antitrust and all the rest had been rendered obsolete and beyond the pale of old-fashionedness, well, of course that's what happened. So, I mean, that's the story I'm trying to tell, is not that it went in some kind of natural way to this profit maximization model above all, accidentally. You know, if all this stuff had happened, let's say in 1970 instead of 1995, it would have played out differently because of different assumptions and norms in our culture and society.
Absolutely. I think, and you've just put your finger completely on the right thing: regulation, institutions, norms. And obviously the fact that there was no antitrust and there was a cultish belief in companies that make money are successful, are superb, are geniuses. I think those are absolutely super important. But what I don't want to lose, and this goes back to the discussion with that we just had about Stuart Russell and the AI field in general, I don't want to lose the notion of social responsibility of researchers and companies. You know, we can't just bank on social responsibility. Institutions and regulations are key, but social responsibility plays a role. You know, there are companies who made different choices. Wikipedia.
Yes, totally.
Jimmy Wales didn't use all his effort, intelligence, and knowledge to enrich himself, but created
and he could be a billionaire if he wished, if he had done the other way.
He could be a billionaire. Mozilla, again, I think, could have made much more money. Linux. So I think people did make different choices. And I think that's really important in the field of AI, because the conceit is that the future is already written.
Yeah.
And there isn't a social responsibility or a important choice in terms of direction that AI researchers should be engaged in. They should just go ahead and do what they are doing best. And I think that is part of, and that really much relates to another thing you, it's very central to your book, and of course we should talk about it, is the Friedman Doctrine. You know, that it is legitimate for businesses and anybody associated with businesses just to focus on money, just to focus on profits and leave other social responsibilities aside. And I think you're very, very accurate in singling that out. But then once you single that out, I think it applies much more broadly than just Friedman and the CEOs. It applies to all sorts of regulators, all sorts of researchers, all sorts of journalists. You know, we're all in it together.
Yes. No, that's absolutely. Well, no, exactly. I mean, just as, you know, Nixon famously said in 1971, essentially, we're all Keynesians now, just as we were on our way to all becoming Friedmanites. And so everybody, whether they are called themselves a libertarian or a Koch brother or not, most people have adopted that, you know, kind of, whether it's shareholder supremacy or profits above all, that idea of how the world works, and whether or not it ought to work just does. So that's a given. Back to our original conversation about the kind of acceptance of certain economics principles or ideas as axiomatic when they are in fact choices.
Well, that's one of the very touching parts of the book. You sort of give your own sort of history there. Are we all neoliberal useful idiots in some sense? I think that's, you don't quite put it that way, but
pretty much. Yeah.
You do use the word neoliberal useful idiots. So, you know, journalists and academics such as myself, I think, you know, we went along with this conceit probably for far too long. And unfortunately, I would have to admit that academics such as myself probably had much less impact than, you know, journalists at New York Times or CNN, which sort of amplified this message, this acceptance. So I think acceptance of these things from the center left was probably perhaps more important than its acceptance from the center right.
Well, no, exactly, because it is tragic and touching and all those things that we of the center left, and starting, you know, people who were actually in positions of power and generation or two older than I, like politicians like Gary Hart, for instance, and all of the essentially leaders and up and comers of the Democratic Party decided, oh, it's reasonable and it's new and it's good to move beyond old New Deal assumptions about how things, how inequities and inequalities can be fixed, and meet people in the center, and it's a new world. Well, and unfortunately, the center left were the useful idiots in this, because they got played by people on the right and the very wealthy who had no earnest intention to meet in the middle and democratically thrash things out. So I agree. And the way that, you know, I think academics were influential in this is, if you're a journalist in 1985 or 19 whenever, and say, well, look, all these academics at Harvard and MIT, they're down with this. So I guess that's what's, you know, everybody that I know and everybody of my class and cultural outlook agrees. So I guess we're all Friedmanites now.
Right. And, you know, like another version of this, you see in the Iraq War, the fact that a center-left government in the UK, Tony Blair, and New York Times and Washington Post became convinced we should go to war in Iraq, I think was more important than, you know, Wall Street Journal and Fox News supporting it.
100%. No, exactly. And it is a whole other discussion about, and I go through this in the book somewhat, the kind of cultural, socioeconomic class solidarity that led the left and the center left, since there wasn't much in America, hasn't been but a center left, to making all these unfortunate choices.
Right. But I think that there's something deeper there, which needs to be explored more. I think you give one little clue of this, but it's not perhaps as central in the book. It's your discussion of the hard hat riot. You know, why is that important to me? Because it's symbolic of the unwinding or disintegration of the coalition that was central to the left. Unions, working classes, and students, or, you know, the liberal elite. But the question is why? And this is like, is it a uniquely American phenomenon, or is this a broader sort of event? And I'm not sure, because it's happened in many other places.
It's not uniquely American, but I think it is. It happened more acutely and intensely, I think, in the United States than anywhere else, I think, perhaps. And I think, first of all, the Democratic Party was a labor party of sorts through the 40s and 50s, but never quite as much as, say, the Labour Party in the UK was, right? And so it was easier in that sense.
It was easier. Exactly the same things have happened in the UK, but organized labor was so important to the Labour Party that it hasn't gone to the same extent. Absolutely, 100% right.
And I do think that there is something about the supposed classlessness of America, which was always part of our self-flattering myth, that when the hard hats versus hippies and yuppies versus proles and all of that thing that we're still living in the middle of today happened, it was more perhaps, again, in its American way, more vitriolic and vicious, because we were supposed to be a society where there were no classes and everybody was in the middle class.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think perhaps we should explain to the readers, in case they haven't all read the book, or, you know, what the Hard Hat Riot was. You want to do that, or do you want? Yeah, you'll be better.
Sure, I can do it. I mean, it was this moment in Manhattan in 1970, the end of the week of the killings of the students, shootings and killings of the students at Kent State who were protesting the Vietnam War. There was a protest memorializing those dead and being against the Vietnam War. And a bunch of union construction workers organized, came and started beating up, rioting against those protesters, and then having vast parades of these white working class people day after day after day through Manhattan. And it was this, and it was the same time that the show, the Archie Bunker All in the Family show came up, and this backlash, this white working class backlash, that was as much a cultural thing as it was really political or economic. It was, you know, it was against hippies and free love and all of this cultural newness more than it was a disagreement about foreign policy in Southeast Asia. And so that's what it was.
But then that exactly. Okay, great. So that's great that you described it for the audience, but that then sets up my next question. Again, I'm asking you these questions because I'm struggling with these things myself.
Sure.
How was that coalition maintained before, and why did it break down then? I mean, you know, that coalition wasn't any easier in the 1960s or the 1950s, was it? You know, students, left-wing liberals, and unions?
Well, it is odd, of course, back in the 50s that Adlai Stevenson, the ultimate pointy-headed liberal intellectual, was nominated for president twice by the Democrats. But only less than 5, 6 single-digit percentages of Americans graduated college, you know, from 1945 to through the early 60s. So this self-conscious new class of the college-educated.
I see. I like that. You know, the educated class wasn't bold and strong enough to.
No, it was tiny. And of course, people who went to college were the elite, but they were just the elite. They were almost not a faction per se politically within the Democratic coalition.
That's great. That's an interesting thesis. There are other theses. You know, one is that somehow these parties, it was the role of the party leaders that redirected the party for the more wealthy, educated liberal elite. And I'm just not convinced that by itself explains it. But there's another interesting thesis. I don't know whether you've read. It's one of the most remarkable books, in my opinion, is by the late Tony Judd, Ill Fares the Land.
Yes.
You know, he wrote it on his deathbed, you know, dictated it, really. And it's an amazingly prescient book, amazingly foreseeing all of the turbulence, political dislocations and backlashes that, you know, would happen about 10 years or 7, 8 years after his death. But he also has a different take, which I never completely bought either, but it's an interesting one. And it's a sort of a left-wing communitarianism in some sense, which is that there was a sense of community that held together the center-left, that people defined themselves as a community, as a nation. And somehow the 60s, he thinks, destroyed that and created an individualism that then spelt the end of that coalition.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm mentioning this only because you have some very interesting parts in the book. You know, some parts of the book, you know, I was very familiar with, but there's a cultural history part of the book that was very interesting for me because I hadn't seen it in that light before. But you don't quite go to where Tony Judd went with that.
Well, it's interesting. The previous book, nonfiction book I wrote called Fantasyland, goes to that directly, and it's more entirely a cultural history of including what I regard, as he does, I think, or did, the 60s as this kind of a big bang moment of ultra uncontrollable ultra individualism in this country, that, yes, led to much of the disarray in which we find ourselves politically. So it's really, these two books are kind of different halves of an overlapping history of how we got into the terrible place we've gotten, one more about economics and politics and one more about culture, including, well, and I go, the subtitle of that book is A 500-Year History, and it goes back to Protestantism and a certain kind of, you know, believe whatever you want, American exceptionalism that has been part of the American character from the very, very beginning.
Okay, so now I have my next book.
Okay.
Because I really enjoy the cultural history book, the cultural history parts of the current book, but yes, it was this wasn't the focus here. In some sense, it was like a transition between different parts.
No, well, and that book was really about this kind of chronic irrationalism and the appeal of exciting falsehoods in America, whereas this one was about these highly ultra rational people who went about doing what they did in the 70s and 80s, and by the way, used the irrationalism of, as I unkindly say in this book, the rabble to get their political, to achieve their political ends.
That is great. But let me take another sort of angle at all of this. And this is, you know, not a criticism, but...
You keep saying that.
I mean it. But, you know, this is a book about the U.S.
Yeah.
But there are parallel trends.
Sure.
Strange parallels around the world. You know, all of these shifts in favor of business and capital, mm-hmm. they've happened in Turkey, in the Philippines, in Brazil,
yep.
in Eastern Europe, in the UK. The retreat of democracy. I don't think your story can be separated, as you rightly sort of mentioned, although it's not the main focus, but it cannot be separated from democratic institutions and democratic participation getting weaker. And again, that has happened in so many different countries. You know, the last 16 years have seen probably the biggest retreat of democracy over the last 80, 90 years. Mm-hmm. So is it all evil geniuses in different settings, or are there other less personal forces at work?
No, I don't think it's all evil geniuses in every setting at all. I mean, for the purpose of the story I tell, I talk about not any most of the countries you mentioned, but the rest of the developed world that has built and sustained and expanded social safety nets and the social welfare state to mitigate the increase in the preferences to capital and that cause inequality and all the rest, all of the evil geniuses work economically. But no, there are the illiberal tide has other sources and it is global. And of course has also, I suppose part of that is China example, which encourages the idea that democracy is for chumps and you can, you know, pull hundreds of millions of people out of poverty if you're an authoritarian state like communist Chinese is. But no, and I talk some about nostalgia in this book, and I talk a lot more about nostalgia in Fantasyland. Obviously, that is, although, again, my Fantasyland is also very much focused on America, but that same thing of this misplaced and toxic nostalgia for the golden, the old days, whatever the old days are, Stalin, or whatever, I think is indeed part of what drives this illiberalism in other countries and is not by any means unique to the United States.
But what are the big trends? That I think requires a little bit more. I mean, China, I completely agree, it has an amazingly pernicious effect. But if you look at these trends, they start before China was really much of a player on the world stage. You know, the last year in which there were more countries democratized than those that went back on their democracy, according at least to Freedom House, is 2004. At the time, China was laying low. I mean, some people think it's globalization.
Yeah.
That globalization has changed the nature of domestic politics. I think there is some truth to that. I think most importantly, it's empowered capital because it's footloose. It can go to other countries. Its bargaining power has increased.
Yes.
But the other thing that I think may be important here is that the fall of communism has emboldened the right, that it has made the right think that it can be more ambitious in remaking institutions in the Western world. You know, in some sense, perhaps, I don't know, the greatest asset of social democracy was that it was a way out of the instability that could lead to much worse outcomes, especially with the Soviet Union breathing down countries' neck or wanting to invade them at the smallest excuse. So the Berlin Wall falls, and you know, Fukuyama's end of history is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the hubrism.
Yes, and even before, I would argue the Berlin Wall fell and communism, international communism imploded as a meaningful thing. You already had, certainly in the United States, if not elsewhere, an organic move toward the right and a taking for granted of, even in the United States, the social democratic apparatus that had been put in place. I think it did embolden the right, but I think at least in the United States, the right had gotten emboldened by the end of the 60s.
Right. That's an interesting, very interesting. Yeah. I mean, your discussion of Lewis Powell, for example, I think is fantastic. But let me, I mean, I know Lewis Powell, I don't believe in conspiracy theories, but I'm most tempted to believe conspiracy theories when I read about the Federalist Society. But
yes, this previous book I wrote is all about like conspiracy theories. They're nonsense. 95% of them are preposterous. But don't let that blind you to these orchestrated campaigns.
Let me give you my interpretation of, you know, one of the names that you mentioned, although he's not as central to your story as Friedman, but Hayek.
Uh-huh.
This great economist, Nobel Prize winner, the founder of the Mont Pelerin Society, and many organizations such as, you know, Cato Institute, for example, are much more influenced by Hayek.
Yes, he is the godhead of whom Friedman is the kind of American disciple.
But here is where I disagree with you. Hayek was all defensive. So Hayek didn't think, I think, my understanding, that he was building the foundations for a business takeover of the world.
Mm.
And I think he would have probably been very uncomfortable with that.
Uh-huh.
He was throughout convinced that the pendulum was swinging the other way, that there would be much greater state intervention, much more of erosion of freedom from very different angles. And his effort to building a coalition was to defend what he thought would be lost otherwise.
Right.
So in some sense, his defensive efforts then became somehow boldened in a way that he probably would not have recognized. You know, his great book, The Road to Serfdom, mm-hmm. you know, was written as a reaction to the Beveridge Report in the UK, because he thought that the Beveridge Report went too far in sort of empowering the state to redistribute set wages, administratively intervene in the economy. But it was sort of a defensive cry in his mind.
Well, yes, indeed. And of course, a different generation and not American and lived through World War II and the binary choice of socialism and fascism and all the rest. But to that point, that it was a defensive cry rather than Mr. Burns of The Simpsons evilly deciding to take over, you know, make a business takeover of the West. The same thing is true, and I try to tell this in the way I tell the story. In 1970 and 71, when Lewis Powell and the young Charles Koch and the rest are freaking out about what they see happening around them, and they take seriously the new left's plan for socialist revolution in the United States, and it's going to be Maoism in America and all that. So, I mean, it shows you the folly of hysterias of the moment that probably are useful too.
Yeah, you have the same thing about wokeism today. You know, there's so many people convinced that that's going to take over, which is like insane. Yes, I know.
So I think at first it was in that Hayekian, like, oh, they're about to wash away free enterprise in America. Let's defend it in the 70s, 71, 72, 73, you know, the early 70s. And then kind of its own volition, the high tide of 60s government intervention and environmental awareness and consumer rights and all the rest, kind of the tide peaked and started receding of its own. And at that point, my evil geniuses, as I depict them, began saying, I guess we're not going to be washed away in a socialist tide. Let's see how far we can go in the other direction.
Yeah. It's like we are successful beyond our wildest dreams. But let me ask you, you know, we're coming to the end of our time, but let me ask you one other question and perhaps give you the floor to wrap it up with that. You know, you start the book with one of my favorite quotes as well from Antonio Gramsci. The crisis consists precisely in the fact that the old is dying and the new cannot be born. In the interregnum, a great variety of morbid symptoms appear. You know, but the way you use this quote very aptly suggests that you think this is a particularly opportune time for change, or almost what, you know, James Robinson and I called in Why Nations Fail, critical juncture.
Mm-hmm.
But why? Why are we, why is this? And you know, you're right. The changes that Biden is attempting right now would have been unthinkable 3 or 4 years ago. But if it was, you know, if we have come here because of these evil geniuses and the ideology that, you know, has sort of engulfed us in some way with somebody directing it or many people in the behind the scenes making small moves, whatever. But why is all of this now creating sort of this Gramsci-esque opening? And then in that context, you have all these great ideas about what is it to be done, which you might want to mention as well. But why now? Why it wasn't 5 years ago and why it's not 10 years' time? Why now?
Well, if I had a simple answer for that, I would give it, and I don't. But I do think, maybe I have my own slight irrationalisms. I am fond of theories of cycles, and I do think that, I mean, I don't think it's coincidental that we had a New Deal era in this country of you know, we didn't call it social democracy, but of social democratic consensus from 1933 to, let's say, 1980, 45, 50 years. And what do you know, this current new era led by the libertarian economic paradigm began about 45 years ago. So time was up. Shelf life had arrived is part of it. But I also think that the last 20 years, the manifest failure of it to do what it was supposed to do in trickle down economics and supply side economics, and it'll be jobs for everybody, and it's all about freedom, and everybody just needs the freedom to make their own way, and blah, blah, blah. That has, after 40 years of the various lines of productivity and corporate profits and median wages going in the ways they've gone since 1980, plus the implosions of iconic industries, all the rest, I think we have now had enough time, a generation or two, for people to begin saying, like, this isn't working out so well. And sometimes they, of course, blame immigrants for why it's not working out so well, or queer people, or whatever they choose to blame. But I think that's part of the reason is that you know, for through the 80s and 90s and into the aughts, people were willing to say, well, no, it's the American way, it's free enterprise. And I think that began to ring hollow to a critical mass of people. And that's why this.
So the failures have become too patently obvious to be ignored. It's time to remake America now.
I think so. But then make America great again.
Exactly.
there's also this other coincidental and connected cultural tides and changes that we have gone from being, you know, for in our entire history, an 85% white country, of whom 80 of that 85% were not college educated, to a very different country where more than a third of people are college educated. And depending on how you define race and ethnicity, 30 to 40% of us are not white. So that, on top of the economic failures of the economic rights project, I think produced these morbid symptoms that Gramsci talks about.
Well, I think this is a great ending because it's more hopeful, you know, when you have a book that's entitled Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America, and it has a fairly accurate description of our predicaments. I think it is great to end on a positive note.
Well, thanks. No, and indeed, I finished it and published it, you know, last summer before, you know, it all could have gone to hell. We could have gone over the abyss in November and December and thus far have avoided it. So yes, I ended because after all, I'm an American with some hope and optimism, and fingers crossed the last 9 months have been much better than they might have been.
Great. Well, this was a fantastic conversation, at least for me.
Mo, total pleasure. And, you know, they say you're not supposed to meet your heroes because you'll be disappointed and hate them and find out they're not worth your heroizing them, but in this case it was such an honor and pleasure because your work has been really important to me.
Thank you, Kurt. That's very, very nice of you, and it was my pleasure. Thanks, and I recommend the book to everybody, Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America. Thank you for listening to us.
Thank you.
Please visit KentuckyAuthorForum.com for more information and for show notes on today's podcast. And please take a minute to rate and review Great Podversations in your podcast app. Great Podversations is distributed by Louisville Public Media. It's a production of the University of Louisville, Kentucky Author Forum. Mary Moss Greenbaum, producer, Evie Clare, associate producer, and Leslie Sissel, consultant. Great Podversations is supported by Bittner's, Brown-Forman Foundation, the Geans Foundation, James Graham Brown Foundation, and LDG Development. We hope you enjoyed this Great Podversation. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to your joining me for the next Great Podversation.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic. Thank you.